You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the country's elite colleges have tried to bring in more students from low-income backgrounds, but the author of a new book says the schools let down those students once they're on campus. Now, Governor Tony Evers announced the sites of the two youth prisons that will be built in order to replace the embattled Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake schools in northern Wisconsin. Evers announced sites in Milwaukee and Outagamie counties. Both Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake have been under criminal investigations for the last few years over charges of abuse and neglect of the children being held at the facilities and concerns for the safety of staff at those facilities. Representative David Crowley is a Democrat who represents Wisconsin's 17th district in the state assembly, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Crowley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this has been a long time coming, this change, this announcement of these new sites. First of all, what do you think of these locations, one of which I believe is in your district?
Right outside my district.
Okay.
It's in Senator Lena Taylor's and Jason Fields' district. But we are excited the fact that they've actually picked some locations. We're looking to see them now, talking to community members, talking to those municipalities that are going to have these state facilities to make sure the community understands what exactly is going into their backyard, but also to get their buy-in as well. Many of the folks have been wanting to see our young people come back home, and this is an excellent opportunity to bring them back.
Yeah, talk about that idea. One of the many concerns about Copper Hills or Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills is how far it was from Milwaukee. How big a difference is that to have something there?
Oh, it's going to make a huge difference. I mean, it's, what, 4 or 5 hours away from the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County. So for these young people to be back in the county, being near not only just resources that community members can give, but just their family in general, and that gives them access to these young people. If we're going to really rehabilitate these young people, they need to be closer to home so we can actually talk to them, really focus on what their needs are. Because at the end of the day, when they are released, they're coming right back to this community.
Now, we had this bill passed that said these facilities up north would close. Mm-hmm. We'd have local facilities for youth. But talk about the timeline. There's been talk about bumping it back in recent weeks. What are we seeing with these two in particular?
Well, when it comes down to everything, at the end of the day, it's not going to be a huge bump. I mean, if we'd make a change in the timeline, it's only going to change anywhere between 3 months and 6 months. There's a possibility of things changing. But at the end of the day, we want to close Lincoln Hills as soon as possible. But in doing that, we have to make sure that these young people are transferred to good facilities that have the education or the quality resources that they need to be rehabilitated. But more importantly, again, making sure that they're near their home, near their family members. And so, again, this is an excellent opportunity. But the timeline, at the end of the day, we're going to do everything to close Lincoln Hills as soon as possible. We're still looking to follow the same timeline that we have right now. But it may be, at most, I believe it'll only be maybe a six-month delay.
So these two state-run facilities, Milwaukee County and Outagamie County, they're not it, right? There's going to be other local facilities.
Correct. So the two facilities that have been announced are the type one facilities, the state run facilities. Now we're going to be convening a meeting through the Juvenile Corrections Grant Committee to actually receive some proposals from different counties that are interested in building a residential secured facility for children and young people. And so we're going to be starting that process very soon because, again, we need to make sure that these young people are closer to home.
Talking to State Assembly Representative David Crowley, a Democrat from Milwaukee, looking at the announcement of two sites for state-run facilities to replace Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake's juvenile correctional institutions. I talked to Representative Crowley, to an expert on youth corrections, just a couple few weeks back, and he said, okay, yes, changing where youth go in the criminal justice system, that's important. But he said if you don't start earlier, if you don't start having more programs to keep them out of that system in
Absolutely.
The first place, you're failing. What do you see as the next steps there?
Well, when it comes down to this grant committee, we're going to be looking at, you know, what the requirements are. What does these buildings look like? What kind of programming will we have in these facilities? And so it's really important that we look at all the resources that are available to us. And so it's not about just locking up these young people, because we don't know what adverse effect that we're going to have on them by locking them up, especially in poor facilities like Lincoln Hills. So it's about looking at the totality of the different alternatives that we can actually provide. Now we're going to be looking at that when it comes down to actually giving these grants out to these particular communities. So it's not about just putting a building up. We want to know what resources do you have available in the community or in government. What best practices will you be following as it relates to the programming and the building or retrofitting of facilities? So we have a lot of different things to look at, but we do understand that locking these young people up is not the thing to do.
Right. The worst case, I think, a lot of people would see is we'd have a bunch of small facilities around the state that replicate the problems we have at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. How do we make sure we don't do that?
Well, I mean, that's really looking at the best practices, but also because it's going to be so local. I mean, the state has been running Lincoln Hills, but now it's really looking at empowering the counties to really look at that. And so it's a little bit more accountability when it comes down to holding the counties accountable as it relates to taking care of these young people. But at the end of the day, we're adopting best practices. We know that we can't continue with the status quo as it relates to locking these juveniles up. So we have to look at what kind of facility that we're going to build, what programs are going to be around them, as well as the wraparound services. So, you know, we know that this is going to be a silver bullet that's going to solve all of our problems when it comes down to the juvenile correctional system. But we think this is a great step in the right direction in making sure that we rehabilitate every young person that comes through those doors.
Now, you mentioned that grant committee. You're chair of this juvenile corrections grant committee. Who's going to be at the table?
So myself, Governor Evers just appointed myself as chair. Charlene Moore, who's been doing a lot of great work with the Youth Justice Initiatives, Executive Director of Urban Underground. But I also know that Fitzgerald, Majority Leader Fitzgerald and Robin Voss gets to appoint three people to those committees. From my knowledge, the only other Democrat that has been appointed to that committee is Senator Lena Taylor. No Democrat has been appointed on the assembly side. And so I haven't seen the full list yet. It's forever changing in my personal opinion. But I think we're going to have a good group of people who want to see changes in our juvenile justice system.
And looking ahead, do you see this as something that Democrats and Republicans are kind of on the same page here? There's a lot the two parties disagree on. Do you see room to work together here?
Oh, absolutely. When you're looking at, I mean, we started working on this last year, and we knew that it was a problem a session ago. And so to see that we've come this far, we know that we still have a long way to go. When you look at criminal justice, we have to see the silver lining when it comes down to it. It's not a partisan issue. We need to figure out how we reduce the number of people going to prison, reducing the number of dollars that we're spending on our prison population, and really diverting that to education, in my personal opinion. So I do see a silver lining. Some people would say I'm recklessly optimistic when it comes down to this. But at the end of the day, you see criminal justice reform happening in all four corners of this country. And so right now we got to get Wisconsin on board with that.
What do you want to see to that point? What do you want to see when it comes to making sure that kids don't end up in the criminal justice system in the first place?
Well, one, I think that, and Governor Evers has put this out as far as decriminalization of marijuana, right? I mean, when we look at many of the low-level offenses, but we also need to put more money into our education system. What are we doing for young people that 8 hours that they're in school, but also when they get out of school, what services do they have access to? What programming do we have access to? So for me, it's making sure that we wrap around not only just that individual student, but that family, because they can all use some resources many of the times. And so we need to put money into great community programming that's going to help these young people and put them on a different trajectory. And I know that firsthand, because if I wasn't introduced to a youth development organization that saved my life and really taught me about the values outside of my own community and took me outside the only environment I knew, I wouldn't be here today. So I think it's extremely important that we focus on getting young people to introduce them to new experiences.
Quick change of topic before I let you go. I can't talk to a lawmaker from Milwaukee without asking about the Democratic National Convention coming to the city next year. What was your reaction?
Oh, man, exciting. Exciting. One, I think it's crazy that we got it, right? And many of us didn't believe that we would get it. Being small town Milwaukee, quote unquote, you know, especially when you're competing with cities like Miami and Houston. But this is an exciting opportunity. I think it's going to provide many opportunities for businesses, entrepreneurs in this city of Milwaukee. But more importantly, it's going to provide a bigger opportunity for Democrats throughout the Midwest to galvanize people and make sure that we're on the right path in taking back the White House in 2020. Along as a plethora of state houses and congressional seats as well.
Representative Crawley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
That's State Assembly Representative David Crowley from Milwaukee talking about plans for facilities to replace Wisconsin's youth prisons. Coming up, as we just mentioned, the Democratic National Committee announced it'll hold its 2020 convention in Milwaukee. There's been a lot of talk about cheese, beer, and brats in the national media. But is that all there is? We'll take your calls on what the delegates and the journalists should pay attention to in Wisconsin culture. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take your calls on what you want delegates and journalists and other people from around the country to know about Wisconsin culture when they arrive for the 2020 Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee. What do you think Wisconsin does well, like beer and cheese? Or do you think those are kind of cliches? They miss a bigger part of the Wisconsin picture. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a listener question about highway signs.
We recently received a question from a listener, Mark Reisner of Madison.
I was curious, who is putting together these signs that you see on the road? They're quippy, jokey, recommendations of how to drive safely.
Huh, we're curious too. WPR's Andrea Anderson went to investigate who creates these messages that appear on digital highway signs.
Maybe you've seen them. Some have said, huddle up before the big game, plan a sober ride. Or, courteous driving is contagious. To find out who comes up with these funny, but serious, PSAs, we head to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation Traffic Management Center in downtown Milwaukee.
That all said, the attachments that I sent in the meeting...
It's here where DOT employees use computer software to put up and take down the messages urging safe driving. And it's here where a team of DOT employees meets to plan so-called creatives for the digital billboards. Communications manager David Hunt is leading the February meeting.
There's one that's kind of straight up, buzz driving is drunk driving.
He has a laptop with a list of all the messages that DOT has used since it began planning creatives for the digital boards in 2016. The DOT has more than 100 messages and is constantly coming up with new ideas. People have even submitted their own ideas through the state's 511 website.
Not a race, leave some space. Have we used that one before?
The goal is straightforward: improve safety on Wisconsin roads.
We are very cognizant of the fact that millions of people are going to drive past the messages that go up on our boards. So we just want them to be as easily digested as possible. And if it creates a little bit of conversation, you know, back when you get to the office by the water cooler, even better. If people are talking about highway safety, that is a home run for us.
Not every message is a slam dunk, and the team knows that. But they try to be in tune with current events and pop culture. For example, at the team's last meeting, they were brainstorming messages that would go up during the NCAA tournament in March.
Or, drive sober, don't bust your bracket. Isn't that the term for it?
Yeah.
The messages can't be long. Here's Stacy Pierce, Traffic Management Unit Manager.
We can't make it too complex that someone driving at 70 miles an hour can't see that and absorb it and as they drive by.
So, are these billboards effective? State Patrol Lieutenant Nate Clark says yes.
It triggers conversation, and from the conversation, because it's humorous or enlightening, it then triggers the greater point of what message we're trying to get across. So I do think they work.
There was a survey done through the Midwest in 2016 that showed that 9 out of 10 people surveyed believe that the DMS boards were an effective way to construe safety information.
But what about them being distracting? Here's control room engineer Dan Schultz.
If something was terribly distracting, we would hear about it because bad news does travel fast.
It does.
After going to Milwaukee, question asker Mark and I hit the road to get his opinion on one of the new messages. It was around 8 p.m. the night after the Oscars, and traffic along the Beltline in Madison was normal. As we neared the sign, Mark prepared to read the message.
No Oscar for best lead foot slow down. It's pretty good. I actually kind of like that one. It's relevant to something that happened yesterday. It's something that I think I could see my dad telling me. It's not too moralizing. It's like just silly enough where it's like still enjoyable. I guess no Oscar for best lead foot. Yeah, that's pretty good.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Democrats are coming to Milwaukee next year. They announced that earlier this week. Their Democratic National Convention will be there in 2020. Now, our question for you, with politicians, media types, and others coming from around the country in the tens of thousands, what should they try, eat, drink? Where should they go? How should they experience a little bit of Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A lot of the reaction initially was on what people might think of Wisconsin, what cheese to get, what beer to get, cheese curds, brats, that kind of thing. Then there was a little backlash, like, hey, Wisconsin's got more than those things. We got those things. We got more than those things, too. Let's find some things off the beaten path. So there's our question. If you want to recommend a Wisconsin beer, cheese, or brats to the world, you can tell us that. Or if there's something else in the Milwaukee area or beyond that you want outside visitors to know about Wisconsin, what is it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steele is with us in Appleton. Steele, hello.
Hey, everybody. I think an important part of Milwaukee history in its early days, there were some socialist people, red flag there, and they came up with parks and a lot of things for the city, for the people to enjoy and to relax in close to home. And I think the young people today, a lot, think of socialism, and I think that should be an important part for what's going to happen there and who's going to speak.
Steele, thanks a lot for the call and for getting us started. I think some people know about that via Wayne's World and Alice Cooper sharing some Milwaukee history, and state Republicans have been highlighting that bit of Milwaukee history since that announcement. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Auroraville. Laura, hello. Oop, Laura, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Okay, so there's a lot of vegan restaurants in Milwaukee, and I think people should check those out.
Are there good vegan restaurants in Milwaukee, Laura?
Oh, amazing. Like, can I say the name of one?
Sure.
Strange Town. You've got to check it out. And also Beerline Cafe and Celesta's is brand new. And there's...
We're losing you there, Laura. Thank you so much for that. And that's a little counter-programming to the people expecting nothing but cheese curds, custard, and brats, Milwaukee's vegan restaurant scene. We are asking for your recommendations for people when they come for the Democratic National Convention this year, the journalists, the politicians, and more. How should they experience Wisconsin? What should they check out? Is it beer, brats, cheese, and custard, or is there something else you point to? Ron joins us now in Greendale. Ron, hi.
Hello there.
What do you want to suggest, Ron?
I think they would be impressed to know that we treasure our water. We'll have Summerfest going roughly the same time, and the lakefront. And also that we have Old World Wisconsin, just about a half hour west of us, the world's largest outdoor museum of history.
All right, Ron, thanks a lot for sharing that. A great suggestion at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Tom with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. What's your suggestion, Tom, for what out-of-towners should see in Milwaukee and beyond?
Honestly, I think one of the best things people should go to see from out-of-town in Milwaukee is the restaurant called The Safe House.
What's up with that? I'm not familiar.
It is kind of a word-of-mouth only restaurant on Front Street, and it is a very entertaining spy-themed restaurant.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that, but I haven't been there myself. Do you have to, like, give a password
to
get in?
Yep, you have to have a password to get in, which I will not say over the radio because everybody should experience not knowing it at least once.
Oh, you could just tell me.
It is just no, because then everybody else hears.
Oh, right, yeah, they're all out there.
Exactly.
And the food's
but
okay?
I would absolutely say people should go. The food is great.
All right.
Food is great. The drinks are good, and the atmosphere is outstanding.
Tom, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Taking your suggestions for what out-of-towners should see in Milwaukee and beyond with that Democratic National Convention coming up. The national media is looking at this. I saw a big piece in the New York Times from a journalist originally from the Milwaukee area giving all kinds of recommendations. Spotted cow is not really a cow was one of them. They gave their custard recommendation. There's a lot of options, of course, in Wisconsin for best custard. You can share yours, 800-642-1234. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us a quick email, ideas@WPR.org. Looking for a couple calls to roll in here. Some of the other things people are talking about, the waterways, as one of our callers mentioned, of course, the Milwaukee Lakeside and things like that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Walker ready now in Madison. Walker, hi.
Hey, I wanted to suggest checking out Lost Valley Cider Bar. It's one of the only cider bars in Wisconsin right now, and they feature a bunch of Wisconsin ciders like Restoration, Cider House of Wisconsin, and Hidden Cave Cidery too. So a lot of people, you know, when you mention beer, they don't realize that there's starting to be a cider culture here now too.
Now, this is just selling and drinking cider, or are we making a lot of good hard cider here?
Oh, we're making delicious cider. Best. And our apples grow so well here. I mean, McIntosh, Jonahback, Cortland, all that stuff.
Walker, thanks a lot for the call. Great recommendation. Catherine joins us now in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to recommend?
So I want to recommend one of my favorite taco places. It's on the south side on 13th Street. It's called Taqueria Arandas, and they have awesome tacos, great prices, and the best horchata I have found in town. So
fantastic. Definitely. Thank you so much. Thanks for all of your recommendations. You can keep it going on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Your recommendations for out-of-towners coming to the state. Coming up, a look at college admissions around the country, some elite institutions trying to bring in more low-income students, but our guest says not always supporting them well once they get there. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at the latest efforts to find a cure for HIV. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, recent news has shown that a spot at an elite college campus can be bought with fabricated credentials and bribery, apparently. The author of a new book says no matter who gets in and how they get there, what happens after students get to campus is also important. That's the focus of his new book, examining the experiences of students coming from lower-income backgrounds when they find themselves surrounded by wealthy classmates on an elite campus. Anthony Abraham Jack is a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows and an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He holds the Schutzer Assistant Professorship at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, and his new book is called The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to spend most of our time on your book, Tony, but I did want to get your reaction to these indictments. A lot of people, dozens and dozens of people indicted for bribery schemes, test cheating, things like that, to get into some of these same elite schools you're looking at.
Yes, I mean, it goes back to an old saying, what happens in the dark eventually comes out to the light. And that's kind of one of the things that I think about when I reflect on this situation. It's remarkable just the steps that parents took to hoard even more resources for their children to break the law. I see this as part of a larger system, a larger culture of people just assuming, amassing as many resources as possible for their kids and even taking extra steps to exclude other people from that, from the places where they live to the schools that they attend to paying $200 to $500 an hour for tutors, for essay writers, or writing the essays for their kids themselves. I mean, this is part of a larger system of class reproduction. These people got their hands caught in the cookie jar.
Now let's turn to your book, and you focus on the opposite end of the economic spectrum from the people who are buying their way into colleges, people from low-income backgrounds getting into elite institutions. What led you to want to study this group?
So there are two things. This is also my story. When I entered college, I was a first-generation college student. I went to Amherst College in 2003, and at the time, Amherst was 1.5 times my mother's annual income. So 1 year at Amherst was 1.5 times what my mother was making in a year. And when I got to campus, I asked myself a question: where are the other poor Black people? And the reason why I asked that question is because so many of my other classmates were talking about riding on private jets, going on island vacations, studying abroad in high school. I thought I was the only poor Black person on a rich college campus. And it turned out when I got to graduate school and was reading all the sociology and economic research, they also did not make talked about low-income students in one way and rich students in another, when really a lot of my peers had gone to preparatory high schools and boarding schools like Andover and Exeter and St. Paul. And so I didn't see my classmates in the literature, but I also knew this story firsthand, given that I lived part of it myself. And so I wanted to investigate, what does it mean to be a poor student on a rich college campus, and show that 1/2 of the lower income students at elite schools, Black, actually graduated from boarding day and preparatory high school, which cuts across the grain. That's not what you imagine when you think about a low income first generation college student who's Black. You don't think boarding school, but really that's where they tend to graduate from.
Let's talk about that group now, the privileged poor, you call them in your book and the title of your book. Who are they? How do they end up in these elite preparatory schools before going to an elite school like, say, Harvard?
Yeah, that's a great question. The privileged poor are lower income students who graduate for boarding day and preparatory high schools. They're economically disadvantaged, but they have access to the academic and social experiences of the top 1%, right? They study abroad in high school. They are taught by PhDs. And oftentimes what I found is that students get in through three ways, through programs like Prep for Prep and A Better Chance, programs that actually work to place lower income students into private high schools, direct scholarship programs at the individual high school. So high schools like colleges have initiatives to diversify their campuses. And that's one way. And then the third way is sure by happenstance, that someone who like as a janitor, a person who works in a bank, one of the bankers says, hey, my son or daughter goes to this school. They have a scholarship program. We should look into it because it's a really good school.
Talking to Anthony Abraham Jack about his new book, The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. And Tony, you look at two groups in the elite school. You look at the privileged poor you were just talking about. They had some of this preparation in a preparatory school. They learned some of the rules of how to be in an elite college.
Yes.
And then low-income students who didn't have that training, that they came out of maybe a public high school. And this is an alien world. Compare and contrast for us.
Yes, I call those students the doubly disadvantaged because they're economically poor, yes, but where they're truly disadvantaged is they typically go to distressed, under-resourced, overcrowded public high schools, especially given that I study lower-income Black, Latino, and white undergraduates. Especially for my lower-income Black and Latino undergraduates, their high schools are very much more disordered and under-resourced compared to their peers. And so they have classrooms that teachers spend more time managing disorder than teaching lessons or making connections with students. And so when they come to college, everything around them is foreign to them. And the example that I use to highlight is the term office hours is thrown around campus as much as extension party, a party is, right? But professors don't really, they always say when office hours are, they never say what office hours are. And so many lower income students who come from public schools, i.e. the W's advantage, encounter a new language, encounter a new world, a new set of rituals that they must then navigate like with their peers, but they have never encountered this thing before. And so what I try to do is I show how social class shapes how both groups move through campus, but show that it's not just that lower income students find it hard to get into this place. It's specifically lower income students who come from disadvantaged communities, because that removes the conversation from individual differences to societal defects, right? This is about the disinvestment in K-12 education. It's oftentimes about neighborhood inequality and all of the things that keep lower income students in more disadvantaged positions.
And let's take a step back before we return to the story of those students about why it might matter who is going to elite institutions and the connections they make there. A lot of people in Wisconsin might think, well, I'm not going there. I'm not going to send my kid there. But for example, I was looking of our 9 Supreme Court justices, all of them had some Harvard or Yale education. Harvard, Yale, and Columbia have an overwhelming preponderance of Supreme Court justices. Just one example.
Absolutely. The thing is, connections do matter. And who you sit next to in class can definitely influence your mobility prospect. But more generally, let's take a step up. Let's take a step back. Elite colleges serve as mobility springboards for disadvantaged groups. If you are a lower income student, if you are from a non-traditional background, going to an elite school or the most selective school of all the ones you are admitted to, you have a higher chance of moving up the economic ladder than where you started from. Right. And that has amazing, amazing effect on people's life chances going forward. But like you said, connections do matter. Who you sit next to, the kind of opportunities that are available to you, and also the resources at the school. I mean, these schools are able to invest in mental health services, career services, study abroad opportunities in ways that less resourced schools cannot. And all of those things matter for the kind of accumulation of cultural and social capital that that students really need in college for college to truly be as big of a springboard as we want it to be.
One other concern you saw for those doubly disadvantaged students, it wasn't just that they didn't know the norms, the rules of what to do at an elite college. There were economic issues, something as simple as, hey, we're closing the cafeteria during break.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's where both the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged face hurdles, right? So they're both still economically disadvantaged. They don't have money. And what I discovered is that at the time of my study, only 1 in 5 schools that have adopted progressive no-loan financial aid policies actually kept their dining halls open during spring break. And some people may say, well, don't they go home? A lot of lower income students cannot afford to go home. And disproportionately, some students also don't have a home to go to, because a number of the students who I interviewed, both among the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged, were homeless during college or even in the foster care system. So they didn't really have a home to go back to. And that brings about food insecurity. Like, these students had to go 10 days not knowing where their next meal is coming from. And so there's some real obstacles that social, again, like looking at how money matters in college goes beyond how much financial aid you get or how much you pay. Like, there's some real consequences for what happens in between convocation and commencement about how money shapes how you move through college.
We're talking to Anthony Abraham Jack from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you went to college, especially if you were a first-generation college student in your family, did you experience anything like a culture shock when you get there? Did you feel comfortable going to, say, office hours or consulting advisors for help? How'd your background influence your college experience? Or if you're on the other side of things, if you work at a college or university, what is out there for lower-income students at your institution? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Anthony Abraham Jack from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We're talking about his new book, The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you grew up in a lower income household, went to attend college, did you feel different than your peers? How about if you were a member of a minority group in a mostly white campus? Are you a first generation college student? What was the experience like, especially those first weeks and months at school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Cole is with us in Milwaukee. Cole, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question for the guest about intersectionality. So with students that are from low-income backgrounds that are white, their experience can be very different, especially like you were talking about with these primarily white institutions, than students from low-income backgrounds that are black, too. So I was just wondering what the guest had to say about intersectionality specifically on campus.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I actually did interview black, white, and Latino undergraduates to focus in on especially lower-income students to see how race shaped the experiences of those who come from similar class backgrounds. And one thing that I did find is that oftentimes people made assumptions that all white students on this campus were rich. And so the white students had to deal with being outed at times, like around spring break, around the jobs that they had. They had to navigate relationships of people discovering their class background after making assumptions about it. And that often led to very, very awkward situations. Rather, the flip side was true with the black and Latino students. The stereotypes that we have of black and Latino students is that they are all poor. So a lot of the interactions cemented that thought that black and Latino students were poor on campus. So instead of being outed, they felt that they were confirming stereotypes with some of the jobs that they had, some of the ways in which their experience was different from their white peers. But I purposely wanted to interview both white, black, and Latinx students so as to talk about the racialized experience of class on a college campus.
That reminds me, thanks for that call, Cole, of a moment, a low-income, I think a Latinx student from the L.A. area was at an elite school, found out, there's a student from Mexico here. Great, we can connect. But it turned out that student was very wealthy, got flown to Dallas Cowboy games whenever he wanted, and there was a different kind of class gap there.
Yes, a lot of students actually had to come to terms with being around students from wealthy background, a lot of the low-income students are being bound wealthy people for the first time of their same race. Because if you look at patterns of segregation in this country, it's not just that whites and blacks don't live next to each other. It's like the income segregation in this country is growing greater and greater. So a lot of students, like the student who encountered a wealthy Mexican student for the first time, he was like, there was no connections. Like he said, I thought I found my people, right? He felt like that was the one symbol of home, the one piece of home that he had, and he had absolutely no connection with this person because this person was talking about being flown with his father to Dallas Cowboy games every home game.
Let's bring on another caller now. Cynthia is with us in Menominee. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi there.
What'd you want to tell us
about?
I was
especially prompted to call by the comment about foster children, students who have aged out of the foster system. That's huge. They don't get support, but UW-Stout has a fostering success, I believe it's called, where they actually reach out to students who have been in foster homes who are coming with no family support, and they're working with those students to get them connected on campus, to get helping them get the supplies that they need, helping them during school breaks so they have a place to go or they can stay in the residence hall. And it's one thing to offer an opportunity, but if you don't have a connection that can help you be successful, the Student Support Services on the UW Eau Claire campus, which is where I worked my last 9 years at the university, we worked really hard to get them connected to campus, to open them to experiences outside of campus, helping them. We would actually travel up to the cities. Many hadn't been into a larger city.
Cynthia, I'm going to jump in and bring our guest in on this now. Tony, she's saying, I think this is a lot about what you're talking about. It's one thing to open the door and get low-income students onto campus, but yes, what do you do once they're there, as she says, to build those connections?
Absolutely. As I say in the book, access is one thing, inclusion is another. And we have focused oftentimes too much on who gets in that we fail to give significant attention to what their experience like once they get on campus. And she is absolutely right, because to understand the student experience and why they adopt certain strategies for navigating college once they get in campus, we have to understand not only where they come from, but where, what they have been through to get to college. We need to be as prepared to help our students from more rural backgrounds as we are from center cities. We need to make sure that we are prepared to help students who are in the foster care, who are in or aged out of the foster care system, depending on when they enter college, as well as we are those who come from, who are the children of alumni. We have to understand the diversity among the lower income students in front of us, so that we are better prepared to serve them and better have a better inclusive campus.
Cynthia, thanks for sharing your experiences. We're talking to Anthony Abraham Jack about his new book, The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Back to another caller now. Dorotea in Madison is with us. Dorotea, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Dorotea?
I wanted to share some of my experiences. I'm a first-generation college graduate and also an international. I was an international student. I'm originally from Bulgaria. And I wanted to share one of the aspects of how the system doesn't work for some of us. In my university, it was required to have meal plans for the first 2 years of studies. And they were actually pretty expensive. They were kind of like market prices, almost like going to a restaurant, maybe not as high, but you could probably prepare some of those meals a lot cheaper at home. And I was also employed by the university at the food services there, so I could get free meals. But I actually still had to pay a meal plan that was quite expensive, and I couldn't really afford, even though I could get free meals or prepare them myself at home. So that was one of the aspects. And the other one that resonated with me was your host mentioned how universities are often closed during some of the breaks, like, Thanksgiving break, spring break, winter break. And a lot of us can't afford the extra expense to pay extra to stay on campus.
Dorotea, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time left, but that really that reinforces, Tony, what you were talking about. Some of those hidden costs is not just the tuition costs.
No, it's not. It is these added costs that are literally sometimes built into the structure of the day. I mean, of the schedule, given like the spring break, Thanksgiving break, people assume that all students can afford to go home or for fun in the sun. But the other piece is like, we're talking about lower income college students, but look at how even that example of the closings of the dining halls and the expense of the dining halls also hurts international students who may not be able to afford to go that far in such a short amount of time, right? So the way in which being more inclusive is not just about catering to lower income students or changing your standards because of them. It's about making the campus better for all students so they can succeed.
And Tony, briefly, as we wrap up, one of the solutions you point to, and you alluded to this earlier, is getting students the experience, more students, the knowledge, the skills, the cultural capital they need to thrive on these campuses, not just students who go to these preparatory academies.
Yeah, I think just at social putting everybody in private school is not social policy, it's abdicating responsibility. That is not the way in which we can actually make our society better. We actually need true investment in not only K-12 education, public K-12 education, but in our neighborhoods, because neighborhoods and communities, because as we know from both rural and urban environments, there are problems and hurdles in those neighborhoods that keep certain students away from college, even if they really want to go. And how do we address those structural problems like joblessness, concentrated poverty, and the like, to make sure that everyone has a chance at achieving the American dream?
Tony, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Anthony Abraham Jack, assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students.